Three Lives by Tuesday Lobsang Rampa, read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Chapter 11. Silence, perfect silence, not a whisper of sound, not a rustle, nothing. Silence, so great that there was an absolute absence of anything except silence. Darkness so dark that Arnold could almost see things in the light. His eyes had been used to light. They must have stored up light patterns, because now, in the darkness so profound, he was getting optic nerve flashes. An absolute absence of everything. Arnold moved, and could not tell that he had moved. Everything was emptiness. Emptier, he thought, than space itself. But then suddenly, a faint point of light appeared somewhere, and from its blue rays were flung out like sparks on a red-hot horseshoe being beaten by a blacksmith. The light was blue, pale blue, in the center, deepening to a purple blue further out. The light expanded. It was still blue, and then Arnold saw the world, the earth which he had so recently left. It seemed to be floating in space. There was nothing but a mass of clouds. It seemed almost like a ball of cotton wool of different colors, black clouds and white clouds, and he had a momentary glimpse of what he thought must be the Sahara Desert. Nothing but sand and desolation. Then, through the earth, he saw other globes, all intermingling, and yet not one of them touching. "I'm going mad," thought Arnold. "Let's get out of here." Then he turned to make his escape. Behind him he saw two glowing orbs. He stared back at them, and then had an impression. "It's all right, Arnold. We know all about you. We've been examining your past. You've done very well in this last life, other than that you have been so lazy you did not rise above the deacon stage. You did not bother to get ordained. That was lazy of you, Arnold." Arnold stared, and the impression came to him, "No, you cannot see us. We're of a different vibration. All you can see is a globe of light, and that is not at all what we look like. Soon you will be one of us, if you wish, and if you do not so desire, then you will have to go back to Earth and clear up a few ends that you left untied, such as the business of staying as a deacon when you could have risen so much higher." "But what are you like?" asked Arnold. "Not everyone knows how a king lives," thought one of the spheres. "People have the most weird ideas about kings and queens, some thinking that they live all day sitting on a golden throne with a crown on their head and holding the orb and the scepter. Kings and queens do not live that way at all. Similarly on Earth, people have many weird ideas about the immediate life after death. They think there is a heaven with pearly gates. Well, there is a heaven with pearly gates for those who think there is. Because here, in a land which is controlled by thought, people are what they think they are. And if a person thinks there are angels flying about, then they will see angels flying about. But it's all a waste. There is no use at all in such a life, and these intermediate stages are so that people can rationalize things and become straightened out. There seemed to be some conversation going on between the two globes, because there was much bobbing and vibrating between the two, and then from one of the globes there came this thought: "We are much amused that people on this plane of existence are so tied up with their habits and customs that they even have to imagine food, which they then imagine that they eat. We have seen," the telepathic voice continued, "some very religious people here who even have to eat fish on Fridays." "Holy mackerel," said Arnold. "That does seem a bit far-fetched, doesn't it?" "But why do people fear death so much?" asked Arnold. "Although I was a religious and obeyed all the rules of the order, I confess that I was terrified of dying. I thought God would be there ready to smite me down for all the wrongs I'd done, but I have always wondered why people fear death so much." The telepathic voice came again. "People fear death because we do not want them to know the truth. Death is pleasant. When one comes to the last stages of dying, all fear is removed. All pain, all suffering is removed. But people have to fear death. Otherwise, they would commit suicide, and there would be mass suicides. If people knew how pleasant death is, and how much better the life here is, then they would commit suicide, and that would be a very bad thing indeed. They go to Earth as children to go to school to learn, and children must be kept in school, not allowed to escape into the joys of the countryside. And so it is that people fear death until the last moment, until it is clear that they cannot possibly live longer. Then they embrace the warmth of death, the happiness of death. But we want you to leave the material worlds and come to the worlds of the spirit," thought one of the globes. "But why is there a material heaven, even though an imitation one, if people do not need material things?" asked Arnold. "Because for an over-self or soul, or whatever you like to call it, it is necessary to get material experience, and in the hardships of the earth one can learn hard lessons in just a few years, whereas if the lessons had to be absorbed by a spirit living in a spirit world, then it would take eons of time. But now we have to show you your past life. Watch." The world in front of Arnold seemed to expand. It expanded so rapidly that he thought he was falling over the edge of a precipice. A precipice? In space? Onto the turning world. He fell, or thought that he fell, for thousands of miles, and then he found himself living just a few feet above the earth. In front of him, there were strange-looking men engaged in mortal combat, wielding spears and axes and even sticks with heavy stones at the end. Arnold looked at them, and one figure in particular attracted him. The figure suddenly rose up from lying on the ground and put his spear right through the chest of an approaching enemy. The enemy toppled to the ground in a welter of blood. "That was a bad deed you did, Arnold," said a voice in his head. You had to live many lives to atone for that. The pictures went on from the times of the Assyrians on through different periods of earth history, and then, at last, he saw the life that he had just left. He saw his early days and the little offenses he had committed, such as robbing an old neighbor's orchard or taking some coins out of a milk bottle which had been left for collection by the milkman. He saw how he had gone to the market a few times and swiped fruit, apples, pears, and bananas. Later, he saw himself as a monk, overcome with the fear that he would not be able to pass the examinations for ordination, and so adopting a supercilious attitude to cover up the fear of his own incompetency. He saw again his dying and his death, and then he seemed to be rocketing out of the earth, going up and up and up, and then landing upon another plane of existence. "You performed very well in that life," said the voice in his head, "and it would be a mere waste of time for you to go back to the earth phase again. We think, instead, you can undoubtedly learn much." "But what about my friends here?" asked Arnold. "My father, my mother, and the many people I knew before. Isn't it rather bad to come and take their hospitality and suddenly go off to a higher plane? Whatever will they think of me?" The voice in his head had a definite laugh as it replied, "If they were worthy of going higher, Arnold, they would have gone higher. And if you do not come out of this building in a form which they can recognize, then they will appreciate that you have gone higher, to a higher plane of existence. When we come out of here, the three of us will appear as globes of light to them, and having seen two enter and three come out, they will know that the third was you, and they will rejoice accordingly at your advancement and your elevation. It will also give them much hope that eventually they may do the same." And so it came about that in his mind Arnold thought, "Yes." And then, to his profound astonishment, he found that he felt absolutely vital, more full of life than he had ever felt before. He felt full of energy, and looking down he could not see his feet anymore. He could not see his hands. While he stared in a somewhat bemused manner, the voice came to him again. "Arnold, Arnold, you are as us now. If you look at us, you will see how you are. We're just masses of pure energy taking in extra energy from our surroundings. We can go anywhere, and we can do anything entirely by thought. And Arnold, we do not eat food as you know it anymore." There was a peculiar singing sensation, and Arnold found that he was following his two new friends through the wall of the Hall of Memories. He smiled slightly as he saw some of his friends outside. He saw the expression on their faces as they noted that three globes went off, but only two had entered. And the singing noise increased, and there was a sensation of rushing, of speed, and Arnold thought, "I wonder why we always seem to go upwards and never down." As he thought that, he got the answer. "Well, of course, we go upwards. We go up to a higher vibration. You've never heard of going down to a higher vibration, have you? We go up in the same way on Earth when you want to change your state. You get away from the Earth. You go up, which is the way. If you went down, you would get closer to the center of the Earth, the thing you were trying to avoid. But pay attention where we are going. Just at that moment, Arnold experienced a shock or a jolt. He could not explain exactly the type of sensation, but probably if he had thought about it, he would have likened it unto a jet plane breaking through the sound barrier. It was definitely a peculiar sensation, as if he was entering another dimension, and that is precisely what he was doing. There was a sudden jolt, and everything seemed to flare around him. He saw coruscating, scintillating colors of hues which he had never before experienced. And then he looked at the two entities with him and exclaimed, "Oh, you are humans, just like me." The other laughed and said, "But of course we are humans, the same shape as you. What should we be?" The great plan of the universe makes it necessary that people shall adopt a certain shape. For example, we are humans, no matter if it is subhuman, ordinary human, or superhuman. We all have the same number of heads, arms, and legs, and the same basic method of speech. You will find that in this particular universe, everything is built on the carbon molecule form. So no matter where you go in this universe, humans or humanoids are basically the same as you or us. In the same way, the animal world is basically the same. A horse has a head and four limbs, just as we have. And if you look at a cat, well, there is the same again, a head, four limbs, and a tail. Years ago, humans had tails. Fortunately, they've done without them. So remember, wherever you go in this universe, no matter in what plane of existence, everyone is of basically the same form, what we call the human form. "But good gracious me, I saw you as a ball of light," said Arnold in some confusion. "And now I see you as super, superhuman forms, although you still have a lot of light around you." The others laughed and replied, "You'll soon get used to it. You're going to be here in this plane for quite a long time. There's a lot to be done, a lot to be planned." They drifted on for some time. Arnold was beginning to see things he had never seen before. The others were watching him, and one said, "I expect your sight is getting used to seeing things here. You are in the fifth dimension now, you know, away from the world or plane of material things. Here, you won't need to dream up food or drink or things of that nature. Here, you exist as pure spirit." "But if we are pure spirit," said Arnold, "how is it that I see you as human shapes?" "But it doesn't matter what we are, Arnold. We still have to have shape. If we were round balls of flame, we would have a shape. And now, here, you are getting your fifth-dimensional sight in focus, and so you see us as we are, human in shape. You see, also, plants, flowers, dwellings around you. To the people of the plain from which you have just come, they would be nothing. Not that they could come here. If they came here, they would be burned by the very high radiations here. They drifted on over such beautiful country that Arnold was entranced. He thought, how difficult would it be if he ever had to return to the earth and describe what conditions here were like. On the earth, or on the fourth dimensional plane, there were no words at all to describe life in this fifth dimension. "Oh, what are those people doing?" asked Arnold, as he pointed to a group inside a very pleasant garden. They seemed to be sitting in a circle, and they seemed, although the idea was quite absurd to Arnold, that they were making things by thought. One of his companions turned leisurely and said, "Oh, them? Well, they're just preparing things which will later be sent forth as an inspiration to certain people on the earth. You see, there are many things originating here which we put into the dull minds of humans to try to raise their spiritual level. Unfortunately, the people of the earth want to use everything for destruction, for war, or for capitalistic gain." They were speeding along now, up in the air. There were no roads, as Arnold was astonished to note, from which he divined that all traffic here was done through the air. They came to more parkland, with a lot of people in the park. These people seemed to be walking about, and they had paths just through the park. "So they can stroll more easily, Arnold," said one of his guides. "We use walking as a pleasure and as a means of getting to places slowly, so that we only have pathways where we can practice pleasurable walking, by the side of a river or a lake or in a park. Normally we go by controlled levitation, as we are doing now." "But who are all these people?" asked Arnold. "I have a most uneasy feeling that I seem to recognize some of them. It's perfectly absurd, of course, perfectly preposterous. It's just not possible that I know any of them or they know me, but I have a distinct and very uncanny feeling that I've seen them before. Who are they?" The two guides looked about them and said, "Oh, them. Well, that one over there talking to a big man was known on earth as Leonardo da Vinci, and he's talking to the one known on earth as Winston Churchill. Over there," pointing to another group, "you will find Aristotle, who, on earth in days long gone, was known as the father of medicine. He had a very hard time getting up here, because it was held that instead of being the father of medicine, he delayed the progress of medicine for many, many years." "Oh, how was that then?" asked Arnold, looking toward the group. "Well, you see, Aristotle was claimed to know everything there was to know about medicine and about the human body, and it was therefore a crime against such a great person to try to investigate further, and so a law was passed making it an absolute death punishable crime to dissect a body or to make research into anatomical things, because in doing so there would be insult to Aristotle, and that delayed progress in medicine for hundreds and hundreds of years. "Does everyone come up here?" asked Arnold. "There seem to be not many people about, if that is the case." "Oh, no, 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 no. Of course they don't all come here. Remember the old saying about many are chosen, but few succeed? Many fall by the wayside. Up here there is a small number of people of very advanced mentality or spirituality. They are here for a special purpose, the purpose being to try to advance the progress of humanity on Earth." Arnold looked very gloomy. He had a terribly uneasy, guilty feeling, and then he said humbly, "I think a mistake's been made, you know. I'm just a poor monk. I've never aspired to be anything else. And if you say there are people of superior mentality or spirituality here, then I must be here under false pretenses." The two guides smiled at him and said, "People of good spirituality usually misjudge themselves. You have passed the necessary tests, and your psyche has been examined in very great detail. That's why you're here." They sped on, leaving behind the pleasure grounds, going up into what in another plane Arnold would have called a high country. He found that with his improving spiritual sight and fifth dimensional insight, it would have been impossible for him to explain to anyone else what was happening. Before they came down to a landing in a very special city, he had one further question. "Tell me, do any people of the earth plane ever come here and then return to the earth plane?" he asked. "Yes, under very special circumstances, very special people who have been chosen to go down there in the first place come up for a time to be, let us say, briefed on how things were at this time, and to be given fresh information as to what they should tell people on Earth. They swoop down, three together, as if tied together with invisible bonds, and Arnold entered into a fresh phase of existence, one which would be beyond the understanding of humans to comprehend or to believe. End of chapter 11. The Old Author's Dream. This is an added portion. Rather than being called chapter 12, it's simply added at the back and called The Old Author's Dream. The old author dreamed a dream, and this is the way he dreamed that dream. He was sitting propped up in his old hospital bed with a little typewriter on his lap. You know that typewriter, canary yellow, given to him by his old friend High Mendelssohn? A nice light little thing, which had quite a merry clack to it when used properly. Miss Cleopatra reclined sedately by his side. She was dreaming of whatever Lady Siamese cats dream of when they're full of food, when they're warm and comfortable. Miss Cleo, not to be too polite about the matter, was snoring like an old trombone, if trombones do snore. But the clack of the typewriter inexpertly pounded was boring and monotonous. The hum of traffic outside was like the hum of bees harvesting in a field of flowers in the summer. The old author had a terrible backache. It felt like broken firewood pressing into the flesh and pinching the nerves. He could not move because he was paraplegic, you know, lacking the use of two legs. And anyway, to have moved would have meant that Miss Cleo would have had her beautiful dream disturbed. And a beautiful little cat like Miss Cleo would always have beautiful dreams, and they should not be disturbed. But eventually, the pain dulled, and the typing slowed, and at last, with a touch of asperity in his tone, the old author said, "Get out of my way, typewriter. I'm sick of the sight of you." And with that, he slid it onto a table at the side of the bed. Snuggling back as best he could, he closed his eyes, and according to later reports from two biased people, he snored as well. A raucous, thrumming, rasping snore, so he was told. But anyway, he snored, and as he snored, he must have been asleep. Many pictures formed before his eyes in the dream. He dreamed that he was floating above the streets, and he knew that he was in his astral form, but he thought, "Oh my goodness, I hope I've got my pajamas on." Because so many people, when they astral travel, forget that according to civilized convention, little pieces of cloth should at least cover certain areas of one's anatomy. The old author floated along and then froze into sudden immobility. There was a two-seater car coming along, and the old term, hell for leather, would be suitable in this instance. It was an open two-seater car, one of those fast English things, like an Austin Healey or a Triumph or something like that. But it was fairly bustling along the road, and the driver, a young woman, was not paying attention at all. Her long hair was streaming out behind her, and every so often she took a dab at her forehead to wipe away the hair, which was obscuring her view. So it was that at that very moment, when her right hand was raised to sweep back the obscuring hair, a car, a heavy old clunker of a car, came out from an intersection and stopped dead in her path. There was one awful bonk, and the rending of metal. The sound, in fact, was very much like when you crush a matchbox in your hands. The old clunker was pushed several feet along the road. A man got out of the driver's seat, bent over, and was heartily sick in the road with shock. His face looked a pale puce with fright, if you know what pale puce is. If you do not know what that color is, well, he looked seasick, or airsick, or in this case, carsick. Sightseers, with staring eyes and slack jaws, appeared from everywhere. Rubbernecks peered out of the windows, and small boys came scooting around corners, yelling to their colleagues to come and look at the beautiful accident. A man rushed away to phone the police, and soon there was that cacophony, which indicated that the police and an ambulance were coming to pick up the remains, and there were some remains. First, the police car skidded to a stop, and then in this neck-and-neck race, the ambulance skidded to a stop. Two policemen jumped out, and two ambulance men jumped out of their vehicle. They converged on the two cars. There was heaving and shoving and many shouts. A policeman dashed back into his car and grabbed the microphone, bawling mightily for a tow truck. He was shouting so loud that it was hardly necessary to use a radio. It seemed that anyone in the city would have heard. Soon, from the far end of the street, there came a flashing amber light, and a tow truck came roaring along the wrong way down a one-way street. But that was all right. They do such things in moments of crisis. The tow truck made a nice turn in the road, backed up to the wreckage. Quickly, the little car, whatever it was, Austin Healey, Triumph or something, was towed back a few feet. As it came to a stop, the body of the young woman dropped to the ground. She was still faintly quivering with the last manifestations of her ebbing life. The old author floated above, making an astral sound which might be interpreted as tsk tsk. Then he looked anew, because above the now almost entirely dead body of the young woman, a cloud was forming. And then the silver cord connecting the astral body and the physical body thinned and parted, and the old author saw that it was the exact replica of the young woman's body. He went to move after her, shouting, Hey, miss, you forgot your knickers. But then he remembered that young ladies nowadays did not seem to wear knickers. They wore briefs or panties or pantyhose or something else like that. And he reflected that one could not, after all, run after a young woman, telling her she had lost her pantyhose or bra and all that. Then he remembered that he was paraplegic. In the excitement, he forgot that he was not paraplegic in the astral. So the young woman drifted off up into the realms above. Down in the wreckage, men were pushing and shoving and scraping up what could have been a couple of bottles of ketchup or raspberry jam. The fire department truck came along, and they connected up their apparatus and hosed down the road, hosed down the blood and the gore and the petrol gasoline on the North American continent. There was gabble, 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 and still more gabble, and the old author got tired of looking at that. Tin pot cars going back to tin pot collections. No, he looked upwards just in time to see the young woman's posterior being obscured by a cloud. He followed. It was quite a good way, he thought, to spend a little time on a hot summer afternoon. So, having much experience of astral travel, he swept upwards and upwards and ever upwards until he outstripped, the young woman, and he got there before her. She was dead to the flesh, and she was alive to the other side. And it was always interesting to the old author to see newcomers approaching the metaphorical pearly gates. So he entered the realm of what some people call the other side, and yet others call purgatory, but which in reality was merely what one should call a receiving station. He stood by the side of the road, and suddenly the young woman popped up straight through the center of the road. She popped up a few feet in the air and then sank back to ground level. A man appeared from somewhere and called to her, "New arrival?" The young woman looked at him disdainfully and turned her head away. Then the man called after her, "Hey, miss, what about your clothes?" The young woman looked down at herself with horror and turned a very fetching shade of pink. It was a good blush. It extended all over her ample form, back and front, top, bottom, and sides. She looked at the man, and then she looked at the old author. Yes, he was a man, too. And then she broke into a run, her feet pounding on the smooth road. She hurried along, and then approached a fork in the road. For a moment she stopped, and then she muttered to herself, "No, I won't take the right fork, because right is the side of the conservatives. I'd better take the left. I might end up with some good socialists." And so she galloped on down the left road. She did not know that both led to the same place, like the old song in the Scottish Highlands where, "You take the high road and I'll take the low, and I'll be in Scotland before you." So the two roads were just an experiment, so that the recording angel, he liked to be called that, would have some idea of the type of person he was going to meet. The young woman slowed to a trot, and slowed still more to a walk. The old author, being wise in the ways of the astral, just floated along behind her. He was enjoying the scenery, all of it. Then the young woman stopped. In front of her were some shimmering gates, or they seemed to her to be gates, because she had been preconditioned to believe in heaven and hell, pearly gates and all that. She stopped, and a nice old angel came out, opened the gates, and said, "Do you want to come in, miss?" She looked at him and snarled, "Don't you call me miss, my man. I'm Ms., and don't you forget it." The nice old angel smiled and said, "Oh, so you're one of those, eh? I thought you were a miss, because you are missing your clothes, you know." The young woman looked down again and blushed anew, and the old angel chuckled in his long beard and said, "Now, don't you be nervous of me, young lady, or should it be lady man, because I've seen them all, backways, frontways, and everything else. You just come on in. The recording angel is expecting you." He opened the gates a bit more, and she entered, and then he shut them behind her with quite a clang. An unnecessary clang, the old author thought, as he floated in above the gates. But the old angel, and she knew it was an angel because he was wearing a nice bathrobe and his wings stuck out from his shoulders and flapped feebly as he walked. But anyway, the old angel led her along a little way and opened a door, saying, "You go in there, go straight along that corridor, and you will find the recording angel sitting in the hall at the far end. You'd better be nice to him now. Don't be too sneering, and don't be too mizzing, or he'll mark you down for the nether regions, and what he says is final." He turned away and nearly bumped into the old author, who said, "Hi, Pop, you got another one here, eh? Let's go in together and watch the fun." The guardian of the gateway said, "Yes, business has been a bit dull this morning. Been so many righteous people coming by, I got tired of letting them in. I'll come in with you and we'll watch the fun. The others can wait a bit." So together, the angel of the portal of death and the old author walked arm in arm down the corridor, and in the big hall at the end they sat down together on astral seats as they watched the young woman, her behind twitching nervously, walk up to the recording angel. The recording angel was a short, fat man, and his wings did not fit too well because they clattered a lot as he talked. It was much the same as an old woman when she talks. Her teeth clatter and nearly fall out. Well, the recording angel was like that. Every time he moved, his wings twitched, and to make the matter even worse, the top sides of the wings kept on nearly knocking his halo off. With some astonishment, the young woman saw that the halo was, in fact, held on with strips of scotch tape. She sniffed hard. Things were very peculiar, she thought. But just then, the recording angel looked at her face. He had been looking at everything else first, and he asked, "Date of death? Where'd you die? Where'd your mother die? Where's your father now? Heaven or hell?" The young woman sniffed and sniffed. She was becoming frightfully embarrassed by all of this. The way people were looking at her, and anyway, some of the pollen from the flowers in the heavenly fields weren't half tickling her nostrils. Suddenly, she gave one terrific sneeze and nearly blew the recording angel's halo off. "Oh, pardon," she said in embarrassment. "I always sneeze like that when I smell strange odors." The angel of the portal of death did a wheezy chuckle and said, "Oh, yes, him, you know," jerking a thumb at the recording angel. "He's a bit of a stinker. We get a lot of people sneezing when they get a sniff of him." The recording angel looked at the papers before him and muttered, "Oh, yes, date of death, date of this, date of that. Well, we don't want that. I've asked the questions, but if the young woman should give me the information, I should be the rest of the day filling out forms. This red tape, you know." Suddenly he looked again at the young woman's face and said, "Say, did you bring up any spare fag ends? I could do with the smoke. And it's a very strange thing, but when people come up here, first they always throw away their cigarette ends. They are a lot better off down in the hellish quarters, because so many smoke there anyway before they're finished." The young woman shook her head in increasing amazement, indicating that no, she hadn't any cigarettes or anything else smokable. So the recording angel grunted and said, "Where'd you die? Did you have a good undertaker?" He fiddled about among his papers and picked out a card which read, "I digs 'em. Bury 'em all unlimited. Undertaking our specialty. Cremation's a convenience." "There," he said, "that's where you should have been fixed up. We get a lot of customers from there. We always know just fine how well they've been treated, because we look at their scars." The young woman was just standing there, and in the end she looked down and let out a shriek of rage. "Look," she screamed, "you've got me down on that form as Miss. I am not Miss. I'm Ms. I demand you alter it now. I won't have this discrimination." She fumed and fumed. She went red all over. It was easy to see where she went red because she had no clothes on. So she went red all over and stamped her feet with temper. The recording angel made soothing noises and said, "Whoa, whoa, steady there now, steady. You know where you are, don't you?" Then he pursed his lips and made the sound known as a raspberry before saying, "Well, miss, We don't acknowledge Ms. here. You have already decided where you're going to go because any women's lib person or any media person is denied the heavenly experience. Instead, they go down to the hellish fields. So there you are, lass. Pick up your feet again and keep moving them forward. And you better get down or I'll phone old Nick now and say you're on the way down. Be sure you give him my kind regards in person, because we've got a thing going to see who can take the most patients from the other. He wins this one fair and square, because you're a libber. He turned away and reached for his waste paper basket. Then, scrumpling up her form, he put it in and carefully straightened up his desk and got out a fresh set of papers. The young woman looked about her uncertainly and then turned to the old author, saying, "Aren't they most unhelpful here? There's such a lot of discrimination. I shall certainly complain when I meet the top brass. But how do I get to the hellish regions from here?" The old author looked at her and thought, "What a pity she has to go to hell. They would certainly give her a roasting there with her bad temper and her smart Alice's attitude." But then he said, "It doesn't matter which way you go. All roads lead to hell, you know, except one, and that's the one you've missed. So just start going down that road. You'll find you're going downhill fast." The young woman snorted and said, "Well, aren't you going to open the door for me? You call yourself a gentleman?" The old author and the guardian of the portal of death looked at her in astonishment, and the guardian said, "But you're one of these liberated people. If we open the door for you, you'll say we're denigrating you and not giving you free rein to your rights, one of which is that you can open the blasted door yourself." The guardian turned with a snort and bustled off to do his duties at the gates, because someone was trying to get in and rattling the bars. "Come along, you," said the old author. "I'll show you the way. I've got quite a few friends down there, and of course an even greater number of enemies, but be careful when you go down there, because about 50% of the population are ex-media people, and they're not very popular. Come on, let's go." Together they walked down the road, and the path seemed quite endless to the young woman, who suddenly turned to the old author and said, "But don't they have a rapid transit system here at all?" No, said the old author. "You don't need a rapid transit system here, because everybody is going to hell as fast as they can go. Just look down at the people on earth now." And he nudged her to look over the edge of the road, and there, to her astonishment, she found she was looking down to the people of earth. The old author continued, "Look at that man down there, sitting behind his big desk. I'm sure he's a publisher's editor or something. Or possibly..." He stopped a moment and fingered his beard before going on, and then, Yes, I know exactly what it is," he said excitedly. "That one down there, he's an author's agent. When you get down to the nether regions, you might fork out a shovelful of hot coal and drop it on him. It will serve him as coals of fire." Then they turned a curve in the road, and before them were the gates of hell, glowing blood red and shooting off sparks in the murkiness. As the two came down the path towards the gates, the young woman saw a really hot devil grab his trident and a pair of asbestos gloves. Quickly putting on the gloves, he reached for the handle of the gates and swung them back, smoking and sending out showers of sparks. "Come along, ducks," he said to the young woman. "We've been waiting for you. Just come in to our party. We know how to deal with young women like you. We'll soon teach you that you are a woman and not just a libber. We'll teach you that you are a sex symbol, okay?" He turned and pushed the young woman in front of him and quite gently put the prongs of his trident to her posterior. She leaped up into the air with an eldritch screech, her feet pumping and running before she hit the ground again. The devil gatekeeper turned to the old author and said, "No, no, old fellow, you can't come in here. You've had your hellish time on the world. Now we'll give you some of your persecutors and detractors a bit of a roasting. You go back up and stir up some more trouble. We want some more victims here for shoveling coal and carrying out the clinkers. Be gone with you. Go." So the young woman disappeared from the old author's dream. She disappeared from our pages as well, and we can only surmise, perhaps lewdly or lustily, at the fate of such a young woman with curves in the right places and bumps in the right places, condemned to such a beautifully hellish atmosphere. Although she herself would have admitted she was not quite good enough for the heavenly atmosphere. So the old author wandered up the path again, keeping his eyes open and his ears open for the sights and sounds which made up such a large amount of the life of the hellish part of the other side. As he gazed about, he saw behind him the inferno. Great gouts of flame shot up into the sky, and things which look like fireballs, those things which are such a feature of firework displays. Then there were showers upon showers of bright sparks going up, describing a parabola and coming down again. Every so often there came hoots and shouts and screams. The whole area was of a ruddy hue, which was most unpleasant. The old author turned away, and as he did so, there came the clatter of the red-hot door opening and shouts of, "Author! Author!" A hellish crew. What a pity they were not a heavenly horde. Came pouring out of the open gates and rushed up the slope, yelling, "Author! Author!" The old man sighed, fit to bust the stitches out of his pants, if he had had any on, and turned back. At this point, it might be as well, because of the lady readers, to make it clear that although he had no pants on, he did have on the appropriate robe, so the ladies can go on looking at the print. There was a lot of beckoning, gesticulating, shouts and all the rest of it, as the author went down the hill again and sat on a bench, from which he rose hurriedly because of the heat. From the gates, a very large man with a pair of well-polished horns emerged. He had a tail with a barb on the end of it, and the tail had a very attractive blue bow on it. I suppose the blue was as a contrast to the prevalent red of the atmosphere. He came out and greeted the old author, saying, "I could do with you here, you know. I could do with you here in hell, and I sure would offer you a very good job. How about it, eh?" The old author looked about, and then he replied, "I don't know about that. This sure is one hell of a dump." you know?" The Lord Satan looked even more satanic and picked his teeth with a splinter from some old coffin, which he had happened to trip over on his way out. As he picked his teeth, the wood charred and gave off tiny sparks, as old rotten wood will do. Some of the sparks fell in the direction of the old author, who fell even more quickly out of their way. Satan said, "You write a hellish lot, old man, that's what I want. I really could do with you, and I have a lot to offer you, you know. What do you want, dames or dolls or whatever you call them, small boys? Oh, don't vomit here. It'll make an awful stink with the press if you do. Or what else do you want?" Well, the old author was feeling a bit vomitous at the thought of the small boys being offered, but then he thought of the dames, or dolls, or broads, or what have you, and that didn't seem very attractive either. After all, everyone knows what trouble women can make. "I'll tell you what," said the devil, with a gleam in his eye, "I know what you'd like. How about a bunch of liberated females? And then you could teach them that this liberation is a stupid thing indeed. Yeah, I can give you any number of these ladies. Some of them are awful people, too. Just say the word, and you shall have as many as you want." The old author scowled and said, "No, I don't want any liberated women. Send them away as far as you can. Keep them out of my way." The devil laughed out loud, and he had a real devilish gleam in his eye as he shouted, I know, how about a few media people? You really could have a hell of a time with them. You could let them write some hot words, and then you could make them eat them. Yes, that would be the thing to fetch you in. Have your fun with the media. They've had their fun with you. How about it, old man? Eh? The old author shook his head once again. No, I don't want anything to do with those subhumans. I regard media people as definitely evil, and they should be your handmaidens, or handmen, or whatever you like to call them. Don't let me get near them. I don't like them. I would even like to strike an extra match under their boiling pot, or whatever it is you do with them. The devil sat down on a fresh spot, and steam rose alarmingly from his rump. He crossed one leg over the other, and his tail swished with the intensity of his thought. Suddenly, he jumped to his feet with a scream of triumph. I know, he shouted. "How about having a nice yacht? Or, as you have always been interested in paddle boats, how about having a nice paddle boat all of your own? You can have a hellish mixed crew, and you can have a hell of a time going around in the hot lakes and all the rest of it. You can have the Red Sea as your playground. It's red with human blood, you know. You'll like it. Hot blood tastes really good." The old author looked disdainfully down and said, "Devil, you don't seem to know much. Don't you realize that if I had a paddle boat, I would be in hot water, because the Red Sea of human blood is just about boiling. Isn't that hot water?" The devil laughed, and he said, "You are making mountains out of molehills. Or should it be molehills out of mountains? Anyway, what's your beef? Of course, down here the beef would be well cooked, but anyway, what is your beef? You've been in hot water all your life, haven't you? I should have thought you would have grown accustomed to it by now." The old author fiddled about in the hot sand with his feet, drew patterns, and the devil looked down and screeched with pain as he spied various religious symbols, such as the Tibetan Wheel of Life, etc. He screeched with pain and hopped up and down, and by accident he got one hoof on the symbol, and up he went in the air with a whoosh, disappearing right over the red-hot gates. When last seen, he was flying in the direction of the Red Sea of human blood. The old author was so astonished that he sat down on the bench again and rose a great deal quicker than the devil had, because that seat was hot, and hotter now that the devil had sat on it. But he dusted off his smoldering robe and decided that this was the time to get out of it. Hell was no place for him. So once again, he moved on up the hill away from the pit, and this time he moved a darn sight faster. At the top of the hill, he met a guardian of the pits who greeted him affably and said, "Hi, haven't seen many coming this way. They're usually going that way. You must have been too good to be let in." Then he looked at the old author and said, "Oh, yeah, man, I recognize you. You sure are some cat. You write them Rampa books, don't you? Well, you're no friend of ours. You've kept many a bad soul from coming to us. You be on your way, old man. We don't want any truck with you. Off you go." And then, before the old author could get going, the guardian called to him, saying, "Wait a minute, wait a minute. I've got something to show you." And then he pointed to some strange device standing beside him and said, "Now, look through that. You'll get a good picture of hell. It's interesting. You'll see all manner of stockades. We've got publishers in this one, agents in another one, media people in another, and over there to the left, we have liberationists. Next door to them, we have a special stockade for old Etonians, and do you know, they don't fraternize a bit. Nope. But come and look for yourself." The old author approached gingerly and then changed his mind in a hurry at the amount of heat coming out of the eyepieces. Without another word, he turned and made his way up the hill. At the top, he saw again the pearly gates. The guardian of the pearly gates was just moving out to close and padlock them for the night. He waved and said, "Hiya, bud, how'd you like it in hell?" The old author waved back and answered with a shout, "No, there's too much of a hellish atmosphere down there." The guardian of the pearly gates called back and said, "It's worse here, in our heavenly atmosphere. We've got to mind our P's and Q's. We mustn't say a bad word. If we do, we have to go down to the pit and stick our tongue on a hot plate there. I should go back and write another book if I were you." And that is what the old author did. He moved along, wondering what else he should look at. Should he see the fountain of pearls or the pavement of gold? But as he was thinking that, he heard a loud clang somewhere. It sounded like glassware being clattered together. Then he felt a sudden pain, and he jumped back to awareness to hear a voice saying, "Come on, come on, it's time for your injection." And as he looked up, there was an ugly, great hypodermic needle coming down to poke him in the rump. The voice said, "What? You writing again about the afterlife?" "No," said the old author. "I'm writing the last of this book. And these are the last words in this book. End of the old author's dream and the end of three lives.